From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the Edgar Allan Poe Tarot. Here's what's happening. Nine leading U.S. and European vaccine developers have pledged to uphold the scientific standards that their experimental immunizations will be held against in the global race to contain the coronavirus pandemic. The companies include Pfizer, GlaxoSmithKline, AstraZeneca. They issued what they called a historic pledge after a rise in concern that safety and efficacy standards might slip in the rush to find a vaccine. The company said in a statement they would uphold the integrity of the scientific process as they work towards potential global regulatory filings and approvals of the first COVID-19 vaccines. Meanwhile, it happened here. A large phase three study testing a COVID-19 vaccine being developed by one of those companies, AstraZeneca, at the University of Oxford at dozens of sites across the U.S. has been put on hold due to a suspected serious adverse reaction in a participant in the United Kingdom. A spokesperson for AstraZeneca, the front runner in the race for the COVID-19 vaccine, said in a statement that the company's standard review process triggered a pause to the vaccination to allow review of the safety. Interesting, isn't it? Several states in the U.S., Midwest, and Northeast have seen new COVID-19 cases increase for 2 weeks in a row, though nationally, both new infections and deaths last week remained on a downward trend. 500,000 U.S. children have been diagnosed with COVID-19, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Children's Hospital Association. Eating disorders are thriving as the COVID-19 pandemic stretches into its sixth month of reshaping American life. Hotline calls to the National Eating Disorders Association are up 70 to 80% in recent months. Let's check in with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com, for his overview. John, what do you think?
Well, let me give you the big picture. And the big picture is, George, that Trump has been going at breakneck speed to get a vaccine. Now, that's something that should be encouraged, you know, because every day we don't have a vaccine, more people are dying. So here's the Democrat talking point right now. Oh, Trump is trying to push it so he gains an advantage prior to the election. Well, guess what? You know, they've also accused him of doing nothing, deal with the COVID crisis. Nothing at all. So we have a vaccine that's almost getting ready to approve. There's going to be some glitches here or there, but we've got so many companies working on them right now. One is bound to pop and complete phase three trials, you know, sometime in the next month or two or three. So here's the deal. In Europe right now, they're having a second wave. They had the largest cases in the UK and in Spain and in France since the height of the COVID crisis in March and in April. So if it's true, as the talking point suggests, that somehow the U.S. is an abysmal failure when it comes to managing all of this, why is it that Europe is having a second wave of the crisis, and they've done such a better job than the U.S. has, and now India is on the verge of overtaking the U.S. with COVID cases? They're not there yet, but if the trends continue right now, India will be have the dubious distinction of the most COVID cases of any country on the planet. And I think it would be well if the listeners would note that when we talk about, you know, the size of the United States relative to Europe, the combined countries of 28 countries in Europe are roughly the same population as the United States. So, yes, the numbers are higher, but the leading French, and this is the kicker, I think, for people to pay attention to. This is Laurent Tubiani at France's National Epidemiological Institute said the reason they're having more cases right now is because France is doing more testing than ever. How many times have you heard the U.S. media slam Trump for suggesting that increasing the testing is increasing the numbers. And the French are finding that the people that are getting the virus now, mainly younger people, are having very mild symptoms. And indeed, across the United States, hospitalizations and the ICU units have gone down by 25 to 30% across the United States. So I think people should keep that in mind before looking at the U.S. as an abysmal failure. We've done a heck of a job managing this crisis, and things are only going to get better when we get that vaccine.
John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. And, of course, I do not agree with him in this case. I do not think a vaccine should be rushed to the marketplace by any means. And AstraZeneca has done a great thing pulling its testing until they figure out what's gone wrong with that one person who got the test vaccine. We have to go at a pace where this works, because a lot of people, millions of people, are going to line up for this vaccine, and it better be right from the get-go. Thank you, John. Popping the Tylenol for that nagging headache could do more than just provide some pain relief. A new study finds that taking the acetaminophen may also cause an individual to take greater risks than they would otherwise. Researchers at Ohio State University conducted a series of experiments to see how the popular pain reliever affects decision-making. In one experiment, the researchers had 189 college students take 1,000 milligrams of the Tylenol-type drug, the suggested dosage for a headache. Some students were unknowingly placed in a placebo instead of the drug. But those that took the drug felt as if that they could do just about anything, including jumping off a tall bridge, bungee jumping. That's weird. Sunshine Mills has issued a voluntary recall of three dog food products due to high levels of mold, according to the FDA. It's a naturally occurring mold product that can be harmful to pets if consumed. Family Pet Meaty Cuts beef, chicken, and cheese-flavored premium dog food, Heartland Farms, and also Paw's Happy Life. Let's check in with food safety coach Jeff Nelkin. Jeff, how does a mold get in dog food, for crying out loud?
Well, you know, a lot of times it may be related to, you know, the rice or the dry ingredients, spices, peanuts that get moldy. So it now we have to look into, you know, where that may have taken place. But I think the most important thing is that the people that are listening that may be concerned, if Sunshine's number for you to call if you have food is 800-705-2111. And the concern is that once or twice, you know, a few times of eating this type of moldy pet food doesn't hurt, but over time it can build up. So it's really important, if you have any questions or concerns, to call Sunshine and don't wait for you know, your pet to have anything from vomiting to diarrhea, other symptoms, and yellow tint in their eyes. So, you know, before you get to that point, call Sunshine and make sure you don't have those items in your home.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Jeff. Jeff Nelkin, our food safety coach. Up next, a friend of the late physicist Stephen Hawking, Dr. Leonard Mlodinow, a physicist himself, joins us with his latest work, Stephen Hawking, A Memoir of Friendship and Physics. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Dr. Leonard Mlodinow back with us, theoretical physicist, noted author. His latest book is called Stephen Hawking, just came out. And he was on the faculty of the California Institute of Technology. And one of his other books is called Elastic, Unlocking Your Brain's Ability to Embrace Change. And he has been a dear friend of the late Stephen Hawking. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. Leonard, welcome back, my friend.
Happy to be here. This is my 12th appearance.
That's fantastic.
Always fun, George.
How much do you miss Stephen Hawking?
Oh, I miss him a lot. He added so much to my life. You know, people know him as a great physicist, but once you get to know him as a person and to see what he went through and the kind of character he had, then that really teaches you great human lessons, far much apart, even beyond his physics.
What a fighter he was, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, every day, every moment of his life was a battle. In the book, I talk about when I was first in his office and I see him, some sweat going down his brow, and I was like horrified because he can't move, and I know what that feels like. It's like Chinese water torture, right? It's just like a little pickle, and we just wipe it away without thinking. And he couldn't do that, and he have to either accept it or wait for one of his carers to notice it and wipe it off. And what he was able to do was really to learn to control his own feelings and his own happiness from within, and to decouple himself from a lot of these outside things that he has to go through. So that, you know, whereas it really would bother you, to him, he told himself that he's not going to be bothered by it. And, you know, people don't realize that in his everyday life, how, you know, feeding him was difficult. They had to cut all the food. He could move a little bit in his head so he could chew a little bit, but some of it would come out.
Yeah, his head was always tilted to the side, wasn't it?
Yeah, he couldn't hold it up. And so feeding was quite an ordeal. He breathed through a stoma, a hole in his chest that would get clogged up, and he'd start to suffocate. They'd have to clear it. You know, moment after moment, hour after hour, he had, you know, horrible, we would each consider a really horrible experience, and yet he learned, you know, how to be happy and optimistic and energetic and have a joy of life despite all that. It was, so how can you be with that all day, every day for, you know, many days and not have that rub off on you and you apply it to your own life?
He had that Lou Gehrig disease, ALS, which, of course, destroyed his entire ability to have any muscle systems or anything. How many years did he have that, Leonard?
He had it for, I think, about 55 years. You know, most people die, it's, I think, within 2 years. He was given 2 years. About 20% make it past 10 years, but he went 55 years. That's a record as far as I know.
As a physicist, and he was one of the best, what did he leave us?
Well, Stephen started a physics career in the early 60s, and you know, it's interesting. Again, it was his disease that made him a great physicist. He was kind of a goof off at as an undergrad at Oxford, and you know, he still did fine. He was brilliant, but he didn't really apply himself. And when he was after he was diagnosed, and then he was at Cambridge for his graduate school, and he was given 2 years. He said to himself, "I want to make my life mean something." And, you know, finding meaning in life is so important. It's maybe the most important thing in life and the most important thing, having you overcome obstacles. And for him, the meaning was to understand where we came from, why we're here, why is the universe the way it is. And he decided to dedicate his last few years, what he thought would be a few years to that. Turned out to be 55. But so he ended up working on problems that no one else, well, very few people were interested in back then. It was the origin of the universe and these crazy things called black holes. And back then, physicists thought that we have no way of studying the early universe, I mean, experimentally or observationally, and the same with black holes. So why study them theoretically? Because we can't test our ideas. And, you know, that turned out to be wrong, and it turned out that those are very important realms to study, and that we can probe them. Later on, technology developed that allowed us to do that, and we learn a lot by studying them. And he was one of the main pioneers who like put that on the map and made it not just respectable, but a hot topic.
Did he talk much about the late Albert Einstein?
Well, of course, all physicists talk much about a lot about Albert Einstein, and one, Stephen studied two theories that he put together. That was his specialty, and one was Einstein's general relativity, which is the theory of gravity, and the other one, and that's applicable in astrophysics, in the large scale of stars and galaxies and the beginning of the universe, and the other theory was quantum theory, which isn't normally applicable in those realms because it's really a theory for the very small, the atoms and subatomic particles. And in fact, the quantum theory and Einstein's relativity, they clash. They can't both be right. They're contradictory. But physicists before Stephen didn't really mind that so much because some of them work in, you know, extragalactic stuff with Einstein's theory and some work with quantum theory, and the clash never shows itself. But by concentrating on the problems he did, such as outside a black hole or the early universe. It turns out that you need both, and those are two of the only situations where you really need both. And he had to make an art of this, of applying a little bit of one and a little bit of the other in just the right way that they don't clash, and to extract some answers. So he was a big, you know, I mean, he idolized Einstein, as we all do, and he was one of the people who took Einstein's theory and moved it forward.
How did you get to know Stephen Hawking, Leonard?
Well, he had read my first two books, so Euclid's Window, which was about curved space, and the second one was called Feynman's Rainbow, a memoir of friendship. That's a new one. A search for.
You've got so many out there now, huh?
Yeah, I've got these two icons of the century, actually. Richard Feynman was called A Search for Beauty in Physics and in Life, about my relationship with him when I was in my 20s, and now with Stephen, in my 50s and 60s. So it's kind of interesting. But he read those two books, and he was looking for someone to write with, because writing and communicating is so difficult for him. And he apparently had been looking for a while and couldn't find somebody that he wanted, someone where he, with a sense of humor, whose writing he liked, and who also really knew physics, like a physicist. And one day I got a call from my agent that his office had contacted her and said, well, would I like to write with him? I didn't have to think very long. Yeah, I think I would. So, and the idea then was to rewrite his famous book, A Brief History of Time, in a way to make it more understandable. He knew that, you know, even though it sold more than 10 million copies, that most people didn't finish it or didn't understand all of it, and he wanted to make a clearer version. And so that's what we did together. That was called A Briefer History of Time.
That's right. And that was a classic.
Yeah. Well. And after that, we, you know, I said, hey, and I was on the faculty at Caltech, and he would come for 4 to 6 weeks each year. And so the next time he came, I looked him up. I said, hey, it was so much fun writing that other book. Let's write a book about your new stuff, you know, because that's all about stuff he did in the 70s and 80s. And I thought he would have to think about it. He was like me. He immediately said, sure. So, but that was all the easy part of that book. Let me tell you.
Leonard, explain to us, what is a giant quantum computer? What is a quantum computer?
Okay, so, well, can I assume that everyone knows how a computer works, or should I start?
We may not know that either.
So a computer is, the idea behind a computer is that you can use the laws of logic or arithmetic to not only to do math problems, but to solve problems in the everyday world, if you just translate them somehow to a mathematical language. So a regular computer does that. It's a bunch of switches that are connected, and they talk to each other. They're either on or off. And by reducing language or reasoning to the rules of logic, you can get a computer to answer questions in business or in math or in different areas. And that's how our phones work, and everything that we use works. You know, it's mm-hmm. basically millions and millions of little switches that are connected in some brilliant way to allow them to do these functions that we want. Now, that's a regular computer. The switches are either on or off, so that makes them, we would call physicists, a classical computer, or just a computer that works in the same way as Newton's laws. Now, quantum theory, if you just look in the realm of atoms, it would be, things behave differently, and a switch can be on and off at the same time. It can have it can be what we call a superposition of on and off. And that sounds kind of weird, but, you know, we won't get into that. I just have to accept that's quantum theory. And so if you make a computer based on switches that are of that nature that can be on and off at the same time, it turns out that you can get a much more powerful, much faster, I mean, extremely, unimaginably faster, better computer that way than the other way. So that's what a quantum computer is, a computer that that works on with switches that are like atoms. The atoms, each switch is, say, an atom or a molecule or maybe the state of a photon, which is a particle of light. People are trying to figure out which kinds of particles to use to build their quantum computers. It's just at the beginning stages now, but that would be the components would be that instead of the switches that we have, the tiny molecular switches that we now have in computers.
Leonard, some physicists think we're living in a giant quantum computer. I'll have you explain that when we come back in a moment. Our special guest, Dr. Leonard Mlodinow. His latest book, Stephen Hawking, A Memoir of Friendship and Physics. It's a great read. His website is his name, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll take calls with him next hour. We shall be back in a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. Now put your theoretical physicist hat on. We're going to take calls next hour with Leonard Mlodinow now as we talk about his latest work, Stephen Hawking. So make sure you're ready for that. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie back with the Professor Leonard Mlodinow here as we talk about the life of Stephen Hawking with Leonard's new book, Stephen Hawking, A Memoir of Friendship and Physics. So back to this incredible quantum computer that some physicists believe that the universe is exactly that. What does that all mean, Leonard?
Sounds like the Matrix, doesn't it?
It does.
Well, you know, this idea also actually goes back well beyond that, the Matrix, even to the 80s. Richard Feynman had mused about this, but didn't really make any progress showing anything concrete. But in the last 5 or 10 years, there's been amazing work, and I do some work in this area too now. I think it's really exciting. We have our quantum theory of all the forces. It's called quantum field theory, or the standard model, which describes electricity and magnetism, the other forces and the particles that we know of, and it works very well. But what people have discovered is that there's a whole other physical model that one can think of, which is think of the space and time is being discrete. Think of space as being a lot of little points instead of a continuum. And each point is, remember we were talking about switches and that make up a computer, right?
So that's right.
If you think of each point as being a quantum switch of the type that makes up a computer, then the universe would be a big quantum computer where all these different points are switches. Now that's just an idea. It doesn't mean anything unless you show that it connected to reality. Well, what people have found is that with very simple programming, that if the universe, each point in the universe were switches, it's equivalent to our completely different theory that we already know works of all the forces and particles in nature. So what we're discovering is that, you know, what we're looking at in our accelerator labs, you know, in Geneva, and all of our experiments, and all as we're studying the forces and the particles of nature, that all that could arise from the universe being on some like more fundamental level a giant quantum computer. And as things are moving around and interacting with each other, what's really happening is the universe is processing information. And that information processing, the grinding through the computer program, is what we observe as reality. It's crazy. It kind of blows your mind. Does that make any sense to you, George?
It does. I'm learning. I mean, did Hawking have an understanding of how the universe was even formed?
Well, he was one of those who contributed a lot to our understanding of that. And it's really amazing because he realized that you need to include these quantum theory when you go back to the early universe. You can't just look at Einstein's theory, which is what people were thinking. And, the universe is expanding, which means if you go back in time, it was smaller and smaller. And since it was smaller and smaller, but it had the same amount of matter and energy in it, everything was packed into a very small, tight space. And that has the effect of really warping the fabric of space-time so that what you think of as time, you know, our intuition for what time is, has no meaning if you go back far enough. It acts like another dimension of space. And so he studied how that works. And his conclusions were that the universe began out of nothing. And not just our universe, but a whole multitude, an infinite multitude of universes began all out of nothing. And some collapsed back, some continued to exist, and they all have different laws. So each of these universes, because of quantum theory, have different laws. And most of those laws would not allow living things or intelligent beings or even stars to form, because things have to be very finely tuned in order for stars to form and the heavier elements, things heavier than hydrogen and helium, things that were made out of like carbon atoms and oxygen. That doesn't come easily. That has to be a very special set of laws that allow that to happen. And so we're in a very rare kind of universe amongst this whole multitude of universes. This was his theory. But it's not a coincidence because obviously in any universe that doesn't allow stars to form and such elements to form and beings to exist, then there's no beings to study it, right? So if we're here studying it, obviously we're in one of those rare universes. So that was his theory of the multiverse, and I thought it was fascinating. That was the basis of our book, The Grand Design. So that's much more detail in that book, but that's what he discovered.
And his thoughts, though, that the universe is started from nothing. What is nothing?
So we physicists have our own mathematical description of what nothing is, which makes it in physics meaningful. It's you know, if you're describing it with words, we use the word nothing, and it doesn't really hold all the meaning that the mathematical terminology does. But it really means a state of the universe where matter is not present, you're in what we would say your lowest energy state, and nothing is present. But because quantum theory allows these fluctuations due to the uncertainty principle, things kind of come in and out of existence. Whole universes can come in and out of existence, and that's what our universe is doing.
That's amazing work. It sure is. When Stephen was communicating through that little device that he had, did that make it easier or more difficult for him to communicate what his thoughts were?
Well, you know, that was the only way he could really. Well, he had two ways of communicating his thoughts. Really, one was typing out, you know, with that little device that he had, pecking. He would just tweak his cheek a little bit, and that would be picked up by a sensor on his glasses and translated into a mouse click. And in that way, like by playing a computer game, he could catch letters and spell words. It was tedious, and it took about six words a minute. But he had developed an amazing, almost like ESP, ability to project his thoughts to his friends. He used his face. He, you know, we all can read body language or facial expressions, but he brought it to another level where somehow sometimes you could look at him and you knew that big frown, he doesn't like something, or a big smile. That's obvious.
Did he have a temper?
Oh yeah. Especially if you didn't, he didn't like it if you didn't understand or even agree with him. One of his graduate students told me, this is back in the 70s when Stephen could still move, but he was in a wheelchair, that he was having an argument with him, and this guy, Don Page, wouldn't give up. And Stephen turned on his wheelchair and charged him with it. He had to jump out all the way.
Yeah, he was going
to
ram him.
And I could feel, I was saying he had these subtle, he had not just the very easy expressions to read, but very subtle expressions that could get a lot of information across. And I felt sometimes that he's just annoyed with me, and sometimes it was like the Don Page annoyed. I better get out of the way. But he couldn't move his wheelchair, but he could get angry. And I, you know, I said, okay, I better, you know, calm down here, calm things down a little. But, you know, he didn't suffer fools easily, and I think he included in that, amongst the fools, anyone who didn't agree with him.
There was a movie done about the life of Stephen Hawking, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was. It was kind of I found it was a mythological, sanitized mythological, version of his life. And one reason I wrote the book, Stephen Hawking, was to show the real, what was his real life like, his real days, what would it be like to be a fly on the wall and watch him, with his relationships, with his physics. And now that was also about his earlier life when he wasn't up and through, I think, the late 80s or so, or even earlier. But, he said, I was at the premiere here in Hollywood, and I remember the producer was very proud because he said, Stephen said that this movie is broadly true. Now, I know Stephen, and that's not a compliment. If you say it's broadly true, that means that, the details aren't true. That's his way of saying, So, but I mean, it was, the headlines of that movie were pretty much correct, but I thought that the way it played out was kind of an idealized version.
Now, he was never given a Nobel Prize, was he? I don't think he was.
No, he wasn't, and we talked about that. And once at dinner at my house, he was visiting here, one of my friends, asked him, which I was embarrassed about, because, he said, why don't you have a Nobel Prize? But he took it very, he didn't mind, and he took it in stride. And look, his work, Nobel Prize is, I think he deserved the Nobel Prize, but I know they wouldn't give it to him because Nobel Prize is given to to people who create the theories that are, you know, when an experiment confirms it, that's when they give the Nobel Prize. And quite often, they don't even give it to the theorists who thought of it. They give it to the experimentalists who measured it. Now, Stephen's work having to do with the black holes in the early universe, a lot of his work is very well substantiated and almost universally believed, like the Hawking radiation. But it's not something that we've been able yet to observe. We need better technology before we could ever do that. And so he knew that that was getting in the way, and that he, you know, therefore wouldn't get one. I don't give them posthumously either. So he would have had to live another, I don't know, 10, 20, 50 years to, you know, to see that confirmed through observation or experiment before he could get it.
Didn't he begin to become a believer in God toward the end of his life?
No. He wasn't anti-God, though, and he didn't want anyone to think that he was. But his attitude was that there's no evidence for God. We don't, you know, there's no need for God in our theories. They stand on their own. But he, you know, his wife, his first wife, and his second wife, and then his girlfriend at the end, were all devout Christians.
Christians, yeah.
And he didn't, and he went to church with them, with some of them, at least. So he wasn't anti-religion, but he didn't believe that there was a God. He also didn't want to publicize that. He didn't want to challenge anybody. He just there.
Those were just his views.
And he didn't think that he had any special insight or any proof. But he wanted to focus on science and leave religion separate. That's all.
See, I would have asked him if I had that chance. How could science develop something as wonderful as the universe and these planets, planet Earth, for example, people? How could it do that without some divine creator behind it? I wonder what he would have said to me.
That's a good question, and I think he would say, well, I understand that, and I feel the same way about how wonderful and wondrous it is. But we don't have any answer because maybe someday we'll have an answer from that point of view, but there's no evidence of what we talk about as God now. So until we have some evidence of it, he's not gonna believe it. But that's why a lot of people do believe that. They think it couldn't have happened, something so beautiful, or why our experience couldn't just come from physics. My friend, you know, Deepak Chopra. Mm-hmm. Always arguing with me about that, you know, and I say, well, you know, I fine, maybe that's true, but let's discover something, not just make it up, you know. So, but everyone goes by their intuition that some all-powerful being that takes care of us must exist, but we don't really, you know, the Bible describes things that would be evidence for it if we could go back or you know, find that the things in the Bible happen, but you know, it seems to be just a story.
Wasn't he a believer in miracles or anything like that?
No, he wasn't. In fact, he was the opposite. He was a believer in there being no miracles.
And oh, jeez.
That the history of science and all thousands or hundreds of years has shown that we've never found anything that's a miracle. In our, you know, as we do experiments, it all fits into either the theories or the new theories, but nothing that's an exception to what we know as natural law.
Leonard, do you know if he ever saw the movie It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart?
I don't. No, I don't know.
Gosh, I would have loved to have had him watch that to get his reaction to angels and things like that.
Yeah, no, that would have been interesting. But in general, he would have said the same thing, that, you know, when he sees one, he'll believe it.
Yeah. What is that?
He's from Missouri.
What is that great Stephen Hawking story you will always remember?
I was at his, this is in the book, I had a near-death experience. I had massive internal bleeding. I was in Cedar Sinai Hospital, intensive care for 10 days.
Oh,
I had 13
God.
Units of blood. Yeah, I was really, and I'm there, and one of the things I'm thinking is, Stephen's going to outlive me, goddamn it.
Yeah. Well, can't say that.
I'm sorry. I'm back in England, and I'm telling him about it. And I go, well, he has brushes like that every year, right? And we start talking about what is life about, what is the meaning of life. I said, we should bet about who's going to die first. And he said, I'm not going to do that because the winner won't be around to collect. or the loser won't be around to pay, I guess. Anyway, at one point I tell him that I know that for him physics is life. And he looks at me and he says, no, love is life.
Oh, that's interesting.
I thought that was amazing. And
coming from him, too.
Yeah, coming from him. And I think that, it just showed how important people and relationships were to him and family. He wasn't just like a brain, in a wheelchair.
When he finally died, what was it that got him?
It was his illness. It was a gradual progression that made it harder and harder to breathe, and that made him more subject to lung infections. He had constant lung infections. And
did he go fast once it happened?
It went over a few months, He knew. Maybe he was ready. Some people say that he was just ready to go. He had done what he could. His communication was down by that point to about a word a minute, and he was just tired of it. But he told a friend, his friend Robert Donovan was visiting him in December before he died, which he died in March, the next March. And he just said, made a comment that, I'm not going to be here much longer. And, Robert was very touched and distressed by that. But Stephen was, I think, resigned that he had played it out already. So, and then he died in March.
Did you ever see him cry, Leonard?
I did. When his divorce settlement with Elaine, his second wife, was accepted by the court, his separation with Elaine was extremely emotionally difficult for him.
Did she file or did he file?
Well, I've talked to people and I've heard both, and one of his friends, close friends, told me, well, maybe she filed, but he had his ways of making, of nudging her to do that. So, they thought that it was came from him either way, however it, actually played out.
But it was emotional for him, wasn't it?
Well, he saw her after that and he was very attached to her, but they had a stormy relationship, and I guess he felt that he had to, at some point, he felt it was best to get out of it.
Isn't it amazing, though, the kind of brain he had, confined to the situation he was, but to be able to be that kind of a thinker?
Yeah, I mean,
just amazing.
I think, when we physicists sit down to work, we have pencil and paper, and we're writing our thoughts down, and, we can look at it, and that's... We need to do that because we can't keep it all in our head. And look at what he did. He couldn't write. He couldn't move. He thought in pictures, though. He didn't think in equations. So he had his own, just like he had his own nonverbal communication, he had his own language for mathematics that he developed based on his disease and his needs. And that allowed him to treat some problems, better than other physicists could, who could write equations, because he had his way of approaching it was actually better. So in some ways, this ability was the superpower. It gave him this new language, it gave him a new focus, and he could treat certain problems that other people couldn't because of his illness.
All right, well, you stay with us, Leonard. We're going to come back and take phone calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.